Welcome to The Voice of Business, a podcast series from the CBI. I'm Alexi Mostras, an editor and partner at Tortoise. We're focusing in these podcasts on the big decisions that people in business are having to make in the COVID-19 pandemic, their coronavirus judgment calls. Everyone is finding their way in this lockdown. I want to hear about the kinds of decisions we are all confronting in these, the most difficult circumstances we've ever encountered. My guest in this episode is John Fallon, Chief Executive of Pearson. John, how are you coping with lockdown?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing? You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. It's a bit weird now that lockdown is kind of half lifted, half imposed. Now, Pearson is a pretty large publishing company. It operates in 70 countries. But I think it's fair to say that it had a slightly higher profile a few years ago when it owned famous titles like the Financial Times, as well as stakes in The Economist and Penguin. Under your leadership, John, it's slimmed down. So I wonder, before we get to COVID, could you just set out a little bit about what Pearson's business is now, how many people it employs, and how its focus has shifted under your leadership?
Pearson, as you say, 175 years old last year, headquartered in London, but a global company operating in 70 countries around the world, just over 20,000 people, about £4 billion in annual revenues. And the complete and absolute focus of the company is now on learning, on empowering people to progress in their lives through giving them access to a great education and the skills and credentials and qualifications that enables them to progress to the next stage in their lives.
So there's been a move towards education, but there's also been a move from physical textbooks, physical educational materials to digital. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So we are the world's leading educational publisher, although most of that, as I say, is now digital. But we're also the world's leading assessment and certification company. We're well known in the UK for EdExcel and BTEC, but we're also responsible for the Pearson Test of English. If you want to take your driving theory test, if you want to take the health and safety clearance to work on a building site in the UK, if you want to be certified by Microsoft to work on their technology, if you want to be approved by Amazon to work on AWS, if you want to be a certified teacher or paramedic or nurse in America, or if you want to go to medical school, you go to Pearson Centre to take the assessment and qualifications for that. And then we're also building big, fully online learning businesses. So we're about digital learning, fantastic experiences, great value, and all leading to a better outcome.
Wow. Okay, well, just before we get into the pandemic, cast your mind back to December 2019, a lifetime ago. What issues in December leading up to this new year were you grappling with at Pearson? What was in your intro?
Well, I had, in sort of mid-December, I had announced my plans to retire from Pearson in the course of 2020. So a lot of my plans at the start of the new year, one, to sort of ensure a good transition successor to to my successor when he or she was appointed. But also, you know, I think it's a matter of public record that 2019 had been a bit of a torrid year for the company. We'd had one or two unexpected bumps and surprises. And I knew that the company was in much better shape than perhaps those headlines and the share price suggested. So 2020 was going to be one about, for me, about transition to my successor, and two, to prove that the company was actually in very good shape for the next phase of its development and its growth. So those were the two things that were on my mind at the start of the new year.
What I'm really interested in is how a big company, an international company like Pearson, how it goes from first hearing about COVID, maybe some reports coming in from China, to a situation where you, as the leader of the company, think this is a global event that we have to dedicate a huge amount of time to trying to get through and solve.
We'd been dealing with it through January in China, the leader of our business in China, a guy called Joe Lam, had done a sort of incredible job of supporting all of our customers. We'd had everybody there working from home for some time. And they, in many ways, set the tone for the whole of the company, because they were looking at how they could support the staff, how they could support the customers, the role they could play in the local community. In a previous life, Joe was a qualified doctor, so in the evenings he was providing telemedicine support to people in Wuhan, where we'd also set up sort of this initiative called Non-Stop Learning, so all the kids at school in Wuhan could continue to have access to high-quality digital materials. So that sort of approach had already taken shape. Italy was, you know, the next major place where it hit. We have a very significant business in Italy, based in Milan, which was obviously very much at the epicenter of where it really hit. And again, a similar approach. Mario Mariani, who runs our business there, huge experience, very embedded in the community. Had everybody working from home very quickly, moved very quickly to have, I think within a week, we had over a million Italian teachers, students and parents accessing free digital materials that we'd made available. But it's interesting, even then, you're sort of seeing it coming, but you're sort of thinking, well, surely it's not going to be quite the same everywhere. That second week in March, I think things moved very quickly, and I think that was true in most global companies. And so about the 7th, 8th of March, we were planning to have everybody working from home by that Friday. So this is now, what, still 2 weeks ahead of the Prime Minister Johnson's announcement. We could see it coming by then, and certainly I think on Friday the 13th, interesting date, I sent a note to all staff around the world to say that from the following Monday we would be working from home.
Okay, and so that was how you organised your employees. In terms of your business and how the business adapted to COVID?
Well, there was one other big decision we had to make with our employees and with the business, and it was this, which is that, you know, whilst probably around 90% of the company could work from home, we were talking earlier about our professional testing centres, so we have a network of these centres all over the world. Those obviously couldn't, you know, that people there couldn't operate from home. So very quickly over that weekend, and I remember visiting one myself over the weekend in Croydon, because I wanted to see firsthand whether we could operate safely with social distancing. And at that point, we felt the need that we had to close all of our network. And that had the biggest and most immediate impact on the business, because clearly then, you know, that was a major source of revenue for Pearson that just stopped overnight. About the same time, it became clear that there wasn't going to be any GCSEs or A-levels sat here in the UK. All of our large-scale testing contracts were going to be disrupted very significantly in America. And so we were at a point then where we had over 1,000 people in the company, probably around about 1,500 people who were not able to do their jobs because the place they would normally go to do their job was closed to the public. And at that time, you know, we did the analysis, and we could have applied for furloughing under various schemes here in the UK, the enhanced unemployment benefit in the US and elsewhere. But we took the decision not to furlough staff. But it was one we had to take in a sort of holistic way. So the first thing we did was really make sure we understood how bad this could get. So we did the sort of scenario planning that I think most companies did. So we ran and stress tested our own financials, because in our education business, we've been going through a very challenging and disruptive analog to digital disruption, where the revenue we lose from physical textbooks declines more quickly initially than the digital growth. We'd been running our balance sheet in a very conservative way. So for a company of our size, we had a very low level of net debt. So that gave us confidence that we had this financial security of significant liquidity. So that then enabled us to say, do you know what? We're not going to furlough those staff. We're actually going to look to redeploy them across the company to support our customers in different ways. Those centres are going to need to be able to reopen very quickly because, you know, the government here in the UK is going to need to get paramedics qualified. The same is going to apply in the US. So they're going to need us to get our centres reopened quickly, and we'll have more flexibility to do that if we hadn't furloughed people. So also the people we would have furloughed would have been the lower paid people in the company and on the whole. And whilst in some countries like the UK, we could have topped up the amount to protect them, that wasn't easy to do in other countries. And we took a view that we had to be all in this together.
So you just continued paying people?
We're continuing to pay all our staff. In fact, the only people in the company who've taken a pay cut are myself, the CFO, and the rest of the board. We've not given that money back to the company. We've actually given it to COVID-19 related charities, because it wasn't about, as I said, we had plenty of liquidity, so it wasn't to protect the company, but it was to demonstrate, you know, that those of us who are in the privileged position have been, you know, well paid for what we do, I think have a particular responsibility at a time like this to show some solidarity.
I read something really interesting that you said, or Pearson said, that you didn't think that the furlough scheme was appropriate because it was put in place to protect primarily small and medium-sized businesses. So I'm wondering, did you not do furlough because you looked at your own finances and you thought, okay, as an individual company, we have the liquidity? Or was it also about the principle that you're a big company and you didn't think it was appropriate on that basis?
For us, you know, as I mentioned, we're the world's leading online learning company. So there were parts of our business that could continue to perform. So it's not like we were in the position of some sectors, like, you know, if you're in the travel or hospitality, where you've just got no income coming in at all. So I'm not making a judgment on other people. What I do think is that as a large company, if you've got the balance sheet and the liquidity, you have a responsibility to look out, you know, to basically take responsibility for your own people rather than to look for the state to do that. And we thought that actually we could redeploy many of those people in a way that would not generate revenue for Pearson, but would certainly help our customers. And our customers would remember that. We were in the position where, you know, schools, universities around the world were suddenly embarking on the biggest ever experiment in online learning, having done virtually no preparation for it at all. So they were having to move at 2 to 3 days' notice. And so what we did was say, look, people will look back after the pandemic and say, how did people behave in moments of crisis? You know, I think that, you know, this old phrase, the cross tests, it reveals who you truly are. And so the question we were going to ask ourselves at that point was, how do we help our customers? And the best way we could help our customers was to say, we've got all these fantastic digital resources and services and capability. If you're a Pearson customer, we're just going to make that freely available to you to make that transition, because our customers will remember those who stood by them and those who helped them in their time of need. And actually, if they then get used to the resources and they find them really good, actually that will create a revenue stream for us longer term.
Are all Pearson employees going to go back to work over the next couple of months? What's the plan to get people back into the office?
You know, I put out a note last week to all staff saying that as of now, we continue to work primarily from home. I think you have to take account of a range of employees. So, you know, if you're a parent with young children, you know, as long as you're able to manage schedules and the like, you need to be able to work from home for a significant period to come, because schools in most countries are not yet open. If you're commuting into London then that's not either realistic option. And also, we don't want our staff taking up precious places on trains and tube that NHS workers and others need to take up. So, you know, primarily working from home. But if you're, you know, some of our perhaps younger professional folk who are living in a, you know, a bedsit or shared accommodation in a very dense part of the city, working in cramped conditions, actually you maybe for your own mental well-being need to get access back to the office. So it will be done in a very sort of phased way, primarily working from home, but I think progressively giving people access to the office. Those parts of the business that depend upon face-to-face engagement are starting to open up again. So our testing centres are opening up around the world, but with social distancing in place.
As you said, it's been a massive shift in online learning. I know I've got two young kids and I'm having to grapple with it myself. And I don't find it that easy. I can imagine that the teachers don't find it that easy either. Do you think that how we educate our children, how we test our children is going to change on a permanent basis as a result of this pandemic?
I think it certainly changes the older the children are and the more they move into sort of adult life. So I think if you look at universities and colleges, they're preparing for the start of the new academic year in September, October. They're all going to move to some hybrid form of blended learning with less face-to-face teaching and more online learning, more virtual school, virtual teaching and the like. And that accelerates a trend that was already in place. I think it will make higher education more accessible, more affordable. It will make it more linked to sort of employment opportunities, and it will generally be, I think, a force for good. I think for younger children, the vast majority will continue to be in school on a full-time basis. But I think there's a role that technology can play there to personalise, to provide more individual feedback, to enable them to sort of collaborate more in different ways. I think you will see, I mean, we do actually, one of the parts of Pearson that has been growing very significantly through this period is in America, we have 75,000 school students who go to purely virtual schools. What's interesting is, you know, the outcomes that those students can achieve is actually very, very strong. They perform very well. But the point is, you can't design a school like that at 2 days' notice. You know, it needs proper sort of planning. And what we've seen now is huge interest in that area. And so I think what you will see is probably a bit of a hybrid approach in schools as well as in universities. I think it's too early to say what the pandemic means for the longer term, probably in any sector. And I think people can overstate now and underestimate how much we long to get back to the world as it was before. But I think what's happened is there are trends that were already at play that get accelerated. I think one of those trends is the importance of business taking account of all of its stakeholders and really thinking about its wider environmental and community responsibilities. And I think this has brought a dramatic shift and acceleration in that trend, and there's no going back. It's clearly going to change travel and environmental factors and our views of the office in some ways. But I think another trend it means is there's much more of an approach to a blended learning, which combines the best a face-to-face that only a great teacher and student engagement can bring, but with all the power of technology to personalise, to provide much greater and precise feedback for you as an individual, to engage and excite students in different ways. So I think, like in many areas of life, this is a trend that there's no going back from and that will be accelerated as a result of this.